Hello and welcome to the Events That Made Me, with me, Liz Taylor. As an international events planner for too many years to mention, I know how important certain moments in your life can be. So I wanted to speak to some of the most interesting people that I know and find out what events made them. And with every interview, you get an air extension, a bonus episode that digs a little deeper on something you can learn from my guests. So let's get started with today's interview. Today's guest of mine is a Northern treasure, one of those guys with a big heart and an even bigger sense of humour, one of the few fellas that actually makes me laugh. So I'm thrilled to welcome the nutty, funny comedian Justin Morehouse. Now, Justin, you and I met through Jenny McAlpine and her late dad, Tom. And Jenny has that same infectious, dry sense of humour as you do. But it wasn't always laughs, was it? And actually, the event that made you, I understand, was at the age of 29 when your career took a totally different path. So come on, tell us a little bit about Justin's journey.
All right. Well, hello. Thank you for having me. And it's a very, very professional that we met and we did this. And so, yeah, I was 29 and I'd never even considered show business or anything like that before. I had a normal job. I wasn't very good at it. And I used to love stand-up comedy. And one day I was driving down the road and I literally thought to myself, how do you be a comedian? And it's almost like a really bad movie. I rang my local comedy club, the Frog and Bucket, and said, how do you become a comedian? And they explained it was like a Monday night, tryout nights. And I booked myself in for 2 weeks later. And it's only when I finished the phone call, I thought, what am I on about? Why am I going to do this? So I spent 2 weeks like writing stuff down, told a few friends, went down. And you speak to any comedian, they'll always tell you their first gig was either absolutely brilliant are totally terrible. It's never in between. And that's what spurs you on. So I did the first one, great. Did the second one, died on my hole, like really bad. And then the third one, it was kind of all right. And then after I'd done three gigs, I genuinely had this thought in my head, which was, how do you say I used to be a comedian? How do you give up? What a sad thing to say, I used to be a clown. Is there a sadder word, phrase than that? I used to be a comedian.
Just roll back a bit. First of all, what were you really not good at?
Okay, Justin Morehouse's potted history, okay? Here's my origin story in less than a minute.
Excellent.
I was brought up working class. Parents both worked hard. Dad was made redundant lots of times through the 80s. And we didn't have much. We weren't like poor, like people are poor today. But we didn't have a lot, you know what I mean? I was really clever. I mean, like intelligent, like beyond my expectations. And in my reading tests and everything else like that, I used to read loads, but I was lazy. I was terrible at doing the schoolwork. So I thought I would, like everybody ever, you know, breeze through my O-levels. And I didn't. I got one. I got one O-level. And it was such a disgrace, such a shame that I left school at 16 and started work. I became a shipping clerk when I was 16. And I started working in for ships agents in the city centre, did a bit of that for a few years. And then I just went off the rails. I think, looking back at it now, I wish I'd gone to university or to drama school or done something to give me that chance to grow up when you grow up. Do you know what I mean? You think you know it all when you're 16, 17, 18. But it took me till I was 24 and I had about 35 jobs.
Between 16 and 24, you had 35 jobs?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah, I just here, there, everywhere. I was very good at knowing when I was going to get sacked.
But hindsight is a wonderful thing, as we all know. I mean, we all would have done different stuff if we had our time again, I'm sure. But you must have been funny. There must have been something. You can't sort of wake up one morning when you're 29 driving down the road and think, actually, I'm going to make people laugh today. Because you've said yourself, you're an intelligent guy. You obviously had an aptitude for English, which means that you must have been good at writing scripts. I think it's the hardest thing in the world to make somebody laugh. There are very, very few people. And whether it's the northern dry humour that sort of floats my boat with you and some of your other sort of peers, I don't know, but it's hard. So were you ever worried it was not going to work out? I mean, you know, you book yourself three gigs at the comedy club, you stand on stage, I'd have died a death. Were you not worried?
Well, I was, but it's that thing as well. I mean, all my friends are funny. Like, you make me laugh, Liz. Like, everybody makes me laugh. But it's the bit, it's that madness, isn't it, that makes you think that what I'll do now. I mean, somebody once said, somebody explained it very succinctly. A comedian is such a strange person that he will stand in a room the wrong way round, looking at more people than, and they're all looking at him or her, and they'll think, these things that I think are funny, I'm going to say out loud to try and elicit a spontaneous response from these people who paid money. It's such a weird thing. But I think I was probably, of all my mates, and we were all funny, but I think I was the one that would take it too far. I was the one that would push the joke. People often get asked when you're a comedian, oh, were you the class clown? Were you the funny one? I just think I was the cheekiest one. I think I was the one that had that kind of extra, would go the extra mile. So I wasn't worried. I mean, if you want to get psychological about it, when I was 29, I genuinely thought everything was up for me. I thought that was it. I thought that was my life planned out. I'd be in a series of jobs that I didn't really like. I wasn't extremely happy with my domestic situation. And that all changed maybe because of the job and everything else. So I was excited more than frightened. And I'm still, people say it must be hard to get on stage and be a comedian. It is. But it's wanting to do it in the first place, which is the weirdest thing. I still get frightened every time I do stand up now. Every time I do a gig, I still get a bit of that. And that's just stage fright or adrenaline or nerves. And if you don't have that, then you're never going to do well.
100%. And that goes in any creative industry, whatever you do. You know, and I know when I organise the events, you can never be complacent. You've got to have that stage fright in order to be successful. What makes you laugh? Is there one person that you've sort of has been your, not mentor, but somebody that you've thought, actually, I like that. I like the way it's shaped. I like the way it's formed. Or are you not influenced by other people?
Well, my comedy heroes in terms of like Les Dawson. I mean, Les Dawson was my hero before I did comedy. I didn't realise I was going to be a comedian, but I liked the fact that he had grown up around here, well, say around here in Manchester, and he'd grown up relatively poor, but he was quite clever. And
I've got to interrupt you here. What made me crease was that you won Celebrity Mastermind and your topic was Les Dawson. I mean, that absolutely creased me. Do you know everything about him?
Well, do you know what the funny thing was? Like, I was a big fan of Les Dawson's growing up as a kid. I read all these books and his biographies and everything else. And I went on to do Mastermind, so I did loads of research. And they never asked me one question that I didn't already know before I started doing the research. I knew everything anyway. I knew everything anyway. They asked me what the punchline was to a joke, and it was either wife or mother-in-law, and I said mother-in-law, and it was wife. But then I went back afterwards and checked it, and actually he's done it about both. And then there was another one about something else, and I didn't quite get it right. But, I was so I was dead nervous about doing that. But comedians do well on Mastermind because it's you, microphone, light, pressure. It's just like doing stand-up. Once you get into a rhythm, you're all right.
Were you friendly with him? Did you know him?
No, I never met him.
That's a shame.
Subsequently, I met Tracy and his daughter and his one of his elder daughters actually came to the recording because I got in touch with him before I was doing it. So that was lovely. But I feel like I know him. Do you know what I mean? I feel like he's been there all my life. I loved him when I was a kid, Blankety Blank and the Les Dawson show and the radio shows and the books. I've always been a huge fan before I ever did comedy. So it's him. Billy Connolly is massive for me. Billy Connolly is like my granddad. I love Billy Connolly. And the other one really is, and it's not so much for his comedy, but it's the way he does his work, is Jerry Seinfeld. Jerry Seinfeld is the comedian. He is our generation's Don. Do you know what I mean? He wrote a book on how to be a comedian. And I just love the simplicity of what he does and the beautiful way he constructs a joke, which is so different than what I do. And he also, Jerry Seinfeld has one of the best rules for the traveling stand-up comedian. It's something that I always live my life by. The three rules for the working stand-up comedian are pack light, eat right, work tight. And I just love that. The idea that if you go into another city, and I do now, I'm big on the one bag travel. So you pack light, you eat right, you work tight, leave them wanting more, all that business. Hi, I'm Justin Morehouse, and you're listening to The Events That Made Me with Liz Taylor.
Now, I know that another event that made you, and would you say that this was the event that made you, was securing a part on Phoenix Nights, which was a platform for some of the most successful comedians. So Peter Kay, Neil Fitzmaurice, Dave Spikey wrote and starred in the show. Paddy McGuinness contributed to the script. How did you get the part?
Well, this was one of the interesting things. I mean, you've got to know me over the years, Liz, and you know the one thing about me is that I'm keen on stuff and like to learn and try things, and I'm up for anything. So I'd been doing stand-up for a little while, and I was getting good at it. I was all right, and I worked dead hard. I had a full-time job, but I worked dead hard at doing the stand-up. I never said no to a gig. And then one night, I went to watch Peter Kay in this marquee at the bottom of Broadway in Chadderton, and there was just putting a special show on. And I'd been a bit of a fan of his. I was a little bit of a, not a stalker, but I was a bit of a fan. I was a fanboy. And I went with Smug Roberts. And we were in the green room. Because I was a comedian then. I'd done about 10 gigs, you know, whatever. And so I was hanging around in the green room. And everybody knew that Peter was making this program. And I said to him, is there any chance I could come for an audition? Because I was interested in learning about what you did in an audition, what the process was, how you would go about that. And he said, and I remember him, it very clearly went in his voice, yeah, you can, because you're the only one that's asked for an audition and not for a part. So everyone else had asked him for a part and I asked for an audition. So I went and I learned something that day. I was at Beverly Keogh's office on Princess Street, and we went in and Peter was there and the director and the producers and other people. And I read for the part, and then they said to me, could you do it like that? So then I did it the way that they asked me to do it. And then Pete went, could you do it the way you did it first? And I did it again. And I subsequently found out that's what they like. They, especially with non-actors, they like to know that you can take direction and you can listen and adapt and everything else. So I went home. Well, went to my mate's house, Mike in Glossop, and the phone rang, and it was Peter. And he just rang up and he went, yeah, you've got the part. And it was amazing. And at that time, I was working for the council. I used to work in the area repair team where people would ring up and say things like, I've had two of your men down my back passage and it's left at a right mess and that sort of stuff, you know, all those classic jokes. And I went in the next day and I said, I won't be coming in again. And they said, why? And I went, because I've got a part in a TV show. And that was it. And then what was magical, what happened then, and because this is just me talking about myself, isn't it? Sorry. But so I got this part and we started filming, and then halfway through it, I did the City Life Comedian of the Year final at the brand new comedy store that I just opened. So this is all within about 6 months of me being a stand-up. Walked on stage, absolutely smashed it that night, had the gig of my life, won it, came off stage. It was clear that it was obvious that I'd won it. It was one of those nights. And then the boss of the comedy store, Don Ward, said to me, who speaks for you? And I said, what do you mean? He goes, who's your agent? And I said, I haven't got one. And he said, I want to look after you. So that week, I got a part in a TV show. I won City Life Comedian of the Year, and I got myself an agent and full weekends at the comedy store, which is like people work 10 years to get into. So that was it. I was away then. But I always think to myself, because I spent a lot of time kind of worried about what people thought about me, because I'd got all these chances early on and, you know, I didn't want to be like ungrateful. But I reckon that every time you're given a chance in life, you have to take it and you have to do your best with it. And I think if you're lucky enough to be given chances, then you need to be smart enough to work hard on them. And that's what I've done, I think.
I think also, Justin, you have to create the chances as well. You've got to create the opportunities. And I mean, that's an amazing story, but I'm not surprised because, you know, you deserve it and you're good at it and you made it happen. But what I want to ask you, which is, you know, you just explained that you had to take direction and you had to repeat your lines. What did you say to them when they told you you were going to play a blue?
Well, this was the interesting thing, you see, because they said to me, I think in the costume or something, they said, oh, do you like football? I said, yeah. And they said, oh, who do you support? So I said, United. And they went, right, we'll give you a United shirt. And I'd seen the script and the bloke who I was playing was an absolute knobhead. So I said, let's make him a City fan. And it was just funnier because at that time, obviously, Because what they didn't want everybody in the show to be a Bolton fan. So we were sitting Bolton, and they had that big scene with when the dwarves turn up and they're all wearing Bolton shirts. So they didn't want everybody to be a Bolton fan. So I just thought it was a bit funnier to be a City fan. But I swear to God, ever since that day, ever since I said that to them, can I wear a City shirt, it's dogged me. Like, for about 5 years, I was frightened to death of going to any derby because City fans thought I was a United fan. United fans thought I was a City fan. I once sat there at the derby, opened the programme, and in the middle of the programme, it says, "Welcome to our neighbours." Big picture of me in a City shirt and my tiger face. And it said, even though he's a City fan in this programme, he actually is a Red. I'm like, don't put my face in there as well. And then people will always say, they'll say to me, they'll go, "I thought you was a City fan." And I'll say, "No." And they go, "Why did you wear that shirt?" I say, "I was acting." You know, Jodie Whittaker in Doctor Who, she's not really a time traveler, you know. Do you know what I mean? You know, that's the difference. Robin Williams didn't come from outer space. He wasn't Mork and Mindy.
Are you sure? I thought he was.
Yeah, I'm positive.
Do you go to the game still? Are you still a supporter?
Yeah, season ticket holder.
You'd be very jealous because I've done all the parties since 1995. So if ever they got through to the FA Cup final, the Champions League, they had a party whether they won or lost. So the first 3 or 4 years, they won every year. And I thought it was an annual event. I thought, this is marvellous. Just set up my own business. And every May, I've got this cracking job for 500 people. And of course, then 1 year, they didn't get through. And I realised, but my biggest moment was Moscow. Went to Moscow with the team. And that was fabulous. So yeah, I support. Well, actually, I support whoever
pays you.
Yeah, yeah, I do.
You know, the interesting thing is about being a United fan in my lifetime. In my lifetime, United have played in 4 European Cup finals, 1-2 and lost 2. I've been to 2. Guess which 2 I went to? The ones they lost. I couldn't go in 1999 because I was working then. I just had a little baby. And then 2008, I couldn't go to Moscow because we were filming Looking for Eric with Ken Loach, you know, the Eric Cantona film. So we couldn't go to that, but I've been to the other ones. But I often get asked to do stuff at United and, like, you know, to do the stuff in the suites and things like that at half-time. But I'm always a bit reticent because there comes a point where does your work life end and where does your social life begin? Do you know what I mean? You don't have a social life, do you, Liz? Everything's work, isn't it?
It's all work-related. But you know what, Justin, and I include you in this, I love the friends that I've made through work. I would never have made those friends. And I think it's the way that we're made, you and I. You either, the chemistry's there, you either take to someone or you don't. I've got the most eclectic mix of amazing friends that have supported me. Yes, it is all work, but you know, that's what turns me on. I mean, that's what gets me up in the morning. I love it. And my cup's always half full. And I love people that are funny. Whenever I chat to Justin, I find myself just wanting to giggle. There's something in his intonation that has me smiling and grinning, and I love it. Laughter is Justin's trade, but laughter is equally as important in all trades. So find out why in the Air Extension episode in your feed, ready for you when you're finished here. Now, this really tickled me. I had a friend who moved to Hong Kong and, being a true Manc, was totally addicted, as we all are, to Vimto. So when I found out that you were selected to be the voice of Vimtoad, I had to share it.
Well, I can't give you a lovely long tongue like this. But I am the Vimtoad.
I want you to just tell us how that came about.
With my lovely long tongue. Well, do you know what? I've got an interesting anecdote here for you, actually. So there's a job that came up and, you know, you have to test for them sometimes. And so they'll test a few people's voices. And I actually did the test for the Vimtoad. This is bizarre, okay, in Dubai. So I was in Dubai working and they said, we need to get you into the studio to do a test for this thing. So I thought, well, when I go into the studio and I explain to these people in the United Arab Emirates that I'm going to voice a frog or a toad, that's going to be the voice of this drink from the north of England. But you know what? Biggest market for Vimto, the United Arab Emirates. It's absolutely huge out there. They drink it, the Emiratis, they drink it very strong. They drink it as a kind of a fruit liqueur. So yeah, so I was the Vimtoad, and it's kind of a, if you've never seen the advert, it's this little toad and he sits in shopping trolley and he's quite Lavacious, is that the correct phrase? He's quite
probably
lewd.
Probably, but I just thought it was a really random piece of information that made me laugh. You've actually had a few TV opportunities, and the one that I want you to just tell me about, I mean, they're all a bit bizarre, Justin. There's this celebrity haunted hotel with John Thompson. Now, don't tell anyone, I've got a bit of a soft spot for John. Did you never fancy being a Lothario on Cold Feet?
Well, do you know what? I never got asked to do anything on Cold Feet. John's been a good mate of mine for quite some time now. And he said to me, "Oh, they've asked me to do this haunted house thing." And I, like, there's two sides to me about ghosts, right? One, I don't believe in them at all. Absolutely don't believe in ghosts, one way, shape or another. Number two, all right, I'm frightened to death. I'm quite a scaredy cat as well. So even though I don't believe in ghosts, I was quite creeped out. But the other thing as well is they were paying me a nice fee, okay? I'll tell you how nice the fee was, okay? I'll prove to you how nice the fee was. I was doing it, and also Anthony Cotton was doing it. Now, you know Anthony. He wouldn't have done it unless there was a nice fee involved, okay? So he was there the day after me. Now, we went into this poltergeist shed, and everyone's walking down, and apparently in this poltergeist shed, it was the most haunted part of the most haunted farm in the most haunted village in Britain, okay? And we're walking around and they were going, "Spirits, can you hear us?" And they had all these detectors and everything else. And I don't know why, but I had a coin in my pocket and I threw this coin. It was completely in the dark and it binged off a milk urn, a churn. And it went ding. And they went, "Oh, God, did you hear that? Did you hear that?" And I went, "Yeah." And they went, "Spirits, was that you? Show us a sign if that was you." And I threw another one, bing, the other side of the thing. And it just, everyone, "Oh my God, oh my God." The third one, as I threw the third one, this voice came over the tannoy. It went, "Would Justin please leave the poltergeist shed?" Of course, they got rigged up all these infrared cameras and they could see exactly what I was doing. And that is the most hate I've ever got online in my life. Twitter and Facebook, "You've ruined it. You've spoiled it. You've absolutely ruined Halloween for us." And I was like, I was just having a joke. And I was frightened about being spooked. But then I went to bed shitting myself, frightened I wasn't going to get my fee. I thought they were going to pull my fee. But they didn't. They paid me. It was all right.
How do you choose your TV opportunities? I mean, what is it about them? Or is it just anyone that'll pay you any money?
Exactly. I don't think I've ever said no. Occasionally I've said no. I mean, I've done a few of those, like My Favourite Biscuit of the Year and things like that. But they get to a point where some of you go, "I cannot be arsed with these." But most of the stuff I've done, I've really liked. I mean, stand-up-wise, to do things like Live at the Apollo and things like that, that's like it's a real career boost, that. I mean, they pay you, but it's a real good thing to do. And I've been in Corrie a couple of times, and I'd love to be in Corrie a bit more. I'd love to have a good stint on it. Do you know what I mean? I think that might suit me to do a year on it or something like that, to see if I could... I don't know, just to get a little bit more famous, do you know what I mean? I don't necessarily want to be a celebrity, but it'd be nice to get a little bit more widely known.
I think you are fairly widely known. Well, I know you. Well, you're widely known enough to come on my events that made me podcast, so you must be fairly famous. Do you think there was a plus, Justin, in starting a bit later in life? Do you think you would have been as successful if you'd gone from 16 or 18 into this chosen path?
We don't know, that's the thing. But there's two ways of looking at it. I've got a lot of life experience, and that when I was 29, I was already from the school of septic knuckles. You know, I was already a grafter. I was already knew that I had to pay the bills and everything else, and nothing makes you get out of bed in the morning knowing that you have to pay the bills. So there was that side of it, that was good. But I do sometimes think I wish I'd gone to university and drama school and maybe done stand up a lot sooner. Do you know why? Because I love it. And I feel like I might have missed out on a decade of loving something that I find a job you love and you've made it. That's what they say, don't they?
Yeah, they do. And you've done some hilarious podcasts yourself. You've done one with Jason Manford.
Yeah, so I have a podcast and basically it's my week. So whatever I do that week, backstage or driving somewhere or stopping for lunch somewhere, or it's just as I go, it's called About 30 Minutes, no more than 45. And it's just like my audio diary of the week, and different people pop up and we have characters on it. Jenny's often on it. She's quite a regular on it. So there's that. And then you get asked to do things. So like Jason's podcast, I think, was his absolute radio show. And the one I did recently, the two vegan idiots, is Kyle Donnelly and I've forgotten what his name is now. It's gone right out of my head. He's a comedian. Oh, Julian Daniels. And they're both vegans, as am I. But that's not the reason for having me on the podcast. I think they have anybody on, even meat eaters. But I'm a vegan, which people are always surprised about, aren't they?
A little. How long have you been a vegan?
About 4 years, but I've been a vegetarian for most of my adult life. And it was only really after speaking to a few vegans don't really like vegetarians. It's quite a weird thing. Vegans kind of like frown upon vegetarianism. Because if you're a vegetarian for animal reasons and for welfare reasons, then you should be a vegan, really. Because the dairy and the egg industry is a bit weird.
Can you drink red wine and vodka if you're a vegan?
I don't drink either, do I?
Oh, I was just thinking if I changed my path, you know, and became a vegan, I just wondered whether I could have
Yeah, red you can. Wine and vodka. Yeah, they're all vegan. If you get vegan wine and vegan vodka, you'd be all right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, have you got a permanent radio job? Just yes. Tell me about the radio stuff, because I know you did radio with Jenny Mack. You did T103, I think, didn't you?
Yeah, so for a long time. So I worked on Q103 from about 2003, 4, something like that, for about 10, 12 years. I had a lovely time doing it. And then, as always, things come to an end. And then recently I've been doing a bit of cover on Radio Manchester, stepping in for them, which I like doing. I'm getting to that age now where I enjoy hosting a garden, phoning and things like that. And now I do a regular show every Saturday. So, yeah, it's good. I really missed being on the radio when I wasn't on for a while. It's a nice outlet for you, and it gets your brain thinking about how to do things. And so, yeah, I'm enjoying that Saturday show that I'm doing on Radio Manchester, and just keep hanging around in case, you know, anybody gets ill with coronavirus and I can do more cover work. We all need a bit more work at this time.
Well, you know what they say. You've got a great face for radio, Justin. Do you create a storyboard? You know, who taught you the techniques and what inspires you in that order? So how do you create a
storyboard? How do I write stuff?
Yeah.
Right. Well, what I do is I write a new hour of comedy every 2 years. So basically I'll start in about January with a few ideas, sort of like, and I'm just seeing I've got one of my books here. So I carry a book around with me. So I have a notepad at all times, and I'll be writing ideas down, and I've got themes and things I'm thinking about. And then as I do stand-up in the clubs and the normal stuff, I'll drip things in and try them out and get them out. And before you know it, you kind of have an idea. You've got some bits. You might have 3 or 4 new bits. And I'm of the opinion that every bit can become a chunk. And then when you've got a few chunks, that becomes an hour. And once you've got an hour, then you've more or less got an hour. Then I spend all of May, June and July working really hard, going all over the country. And a lot of them, it's a beautiful time of year. You're driving through hay fields and you go to these country pubs and little gigs, and you do the preview season for the Edinburgh Festival. I'll do that about 35 times. And then as I drive there, I listen to last night's show that I recorded. And then on the way home, I listen to that night's show. So I listen to every show twice. And you change it and you pick up the little bits and, you know, and all that sort of stuff. And I'll make notes and then I'll go and do the next one. And then we go to the Edinburgh Festival for a month. And then after that, I've done it about 60 times, it should be ready. And then you take it on tour and try and do about 100 dates. And for the last two shows, I've had a director working with me. So the first one I had, Joyce Branner. I don't know if you know Joyce. Kenneth's sister. It would be weird if it wasn't it? And then the last show that I did, unbelievably, I got Henry Normal to direct and assist me on the show. And he was really good. He gave me the kind of, don't worry about not being funny for a minute. Do you know what I mean? Letting stuff breathe, because it will be funny in the end. And he gave me an idea of storytelling, because he's a poet. And he's also, because of his background in television, he knows how to present things and how to show ideas and things like that. So that's what I do, really. And I'm always thinking, I mean, I'm not... The one bad thing that I do that I'll admit to on this podcast is I am guilty of doing a bit to friends and family. So I'll think of an idea of a little story and I'll do it to them as though it's a real conversation and see how they react.
Go on, give us an example. What's the nastiest thing you've
Well, there's a thing that I've been working on. Well, not nasty, but the thing that I'm working on at the minute, and it is a conversation thing, is for me, this is really funny, and it's quite interesting that when you start telling the story, people are a little taken aback. So here goes. Here's the story. So my dad died in September, okay? My dad passed away, and it was quite quick. He'd been ill for a little bit, and we were all very sad and everything else, and we were all there. And we all sat around, and we were waiting for my dad to die. I mean, we didn't do it, you know what I mean? But we'd agreed that it was going to happen. We were taking him off the life support machine. And we're all sat around my mum, my brothers, my sister, me, my own son. And we were all stood around my dad's bed. And it's what you talk about at those times, you know? What do you say? If you say something, it can be weird. If you say nothing, it can be like this, awkward. What do you say? I'll tell you what you don't say, what our kid said. What do you fancy doing after this? What do you fancy doing after this? Huh? And I just thought, what a weird thing to say. And then my sister went, I could eat. And I looked at my mum, I thought my mum is just going to be, and my mum went, I've not had my dinner yet. So literally, this is what happened. My dad died and we went for tapas. And that is the sort of thing that makes me laugh. We all sat around eating tapas. And you know what? My dad, he'd have hated that. He hates tapas. He's like a northern bloke. He's like, it looks great value on paper, but the portions are tiny. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about at the minute. So that's the kind of stuff. And I will be doing that in my new show, is talking about those awkward moments, the bits that make us cringe, but are funny. Do you know what I mean?
But they're very, very real. That is a real conversation. Real. There are so many people that, you know, definitely that would relate to that. And you don't realise how funny it is until it's delivered exactly as you've delivered. Yeah. So it's your delivery and your sort of, and your timing, you know, your sense of, and spontaneity, I suppose, that makes you a very, very funny man. And I've been thrilled to have this 45 minutes with you. Oh. 30, not longer than 45, Justin. To have you. And I really, keep on going, because you just are, you make the world laugh, and you can't want more than that. So thank you so much. I loved chatting to Justin Morehouse. He is the warmest, funniest guy. Very dry sense of humour. Maybe looks a little bit intimidating to some, but I know him quite well, and I laugh from, even if I'm walking into a coffee shop, I'm laughing as I'm looking at him. And those are the sort of people I want in my life. Make sure that you listen to the Bonus Air Extension episode, where I uncover why laughter is the best medicine, whether it be personally or professionally. You have to be able to laugh. You can hear a new episode of Events That Made Me every Wednesday. My next guest is Katie McGlynn.
A lot of my friends was out every weekend, and I were getting up, going to my drama class every Saturday, and that was my passion, and that's what I did.
She's up for a BAFTA for her role as Sinead Tinker in Coronation Street, where she portrayed the challenges of a young girl with a terminal illness. It was one of the best things on TV last year. She was incredible. It came from her soul, and I can't wait for you to hear all about it. Thank you for listening. And if you loved this episode, make sure you leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts, and that you hit that subscribe or follow button so you automatically get the next episode in your feed. And you can find me on all the socials as @LizTaylorConsultancy. Tag me in and I will reply.